to Innovation Alberta. I'm your host, Cheryl Croucher. This is the first episode in a new series on CKUA, and we'll be focusing on the bounty of research underway in this province. Our many researchers are taking Alberta to the leading edge of science and technology, and the impact of their innovations is being felt around the world. In the weeks ahead, you'll have a chance to hear about what these scientists are working on, what makes them tick, and what dilemmas they face in a fast-paced and changing world. Among the stories tonight on Innovation Alberta, we'll celebrate the 80th anniversary of the Alberta Research Council. Historian Michael Payne takes us back to the days just after World War I. That's when the university, government, and business melded in a cooperative effort to apply research and technology to practical everyday problems. And their first efforts focused on getting tar out of the tar sands to make better roads in this new and expanding province. The present-day CEO of the Alberta Research Council is a fellow named John McDougall. He introduces us to some of the world-class accomplishments of the ARC and what the new millennium will bring. We'll also meet Cindy Chappelle, a bright young researcher whose work on Giardia and Cryptosporidium in the North Saskatchewan watershed has grabbed the attention of water utilities across the continent. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Now let's hear what these incredible people have to say on Innovation Alberta. This month marks the 80th birthday of the Alberta Research Council. Today, you'll find the main research facilities of the council on Carl Clark Road, and that's on the southern edge of Edmonton's Research Park. Recently, I took a tour of the ARC's forestry labs, and I had a chance afterwards to sit down with the managing director and chief executive officer of the ARC, John McDougall. John is an engineer by profession, and he joined the Alberta Research Council in 1997.
Well, engineers are very interested in technology, of course, and the Research Council is very much an applied place where we're really trying to move technology from basic ideas into marketable products and services, and that really is an engineering role in many ways.
Now, the Research Council has a very long history. You're celebrating the 80th anniversary now, and here is something that's lasted a very long time and is becoming very important to research in Alberta and also economic activity. Where do you see the Research Council fitting in today?
Well, you're right, first of all, Cheryl. We are very much an important element in the fabric of the research and development community, but our role really is to develop and commercialize technology, and in that respect, we work closely with universities and on the one hand, and we work on the other side with industry. So we're kind of really a bridge between basic science and the marketplace.
How are things working now?
Well, I think if you judge by how we're growing, they're working quite well. In the last few years, after the cutbacks of the early 1990s, when the Research Council had shrunk to just over 300 people, today we're back over 600, and we're very excited about the fact that we'll probably exceed $80 million of revenue in our 80th birthday year.
Now, the revenue, where is that actually coming from?
Well, it comes from three areas. We get some revenue from the government to do what we call public good work, which really is the work that's important to the future of the province in the long term, but which industry sees as too far away or too high risk to participate in yet. The second area is contract work, and there people come and they basically buy our expertise or access to our equipment to work with problems which they have and would like to solve. And the third area is the actual commercialization of technology. We'll take ideas and we'll move them along to the point where they're market ready. And then we'll find a partner, if one exists, to carry it into the marketplace, or if not, we'll create a company to do it.
And what are the different areas that the Research Council is actually working in? I just actually took a tour of the forestry area, and it's amazing the kind of stuff that's going on.
Well, it is an amazing place, and what's fascinating is to see how it's evolved over the years, actually. You know, we began focused very much on coal and oil sands, which were giant resources in Alberta years and years ago and recognized as important, but people didn't know really much what they could do with them. And so we've had long-standing activity in those areas. Today, though, what would surprise most people is that the biggest part of our activities are actually in life sciences. in things related to human and animal health, crop development, genomics, how things grow, what the proteins are, and so on. We're also active, as you noted correctly, in the forestry area, right from the growing of trees to the harvesting to the turning them into products. And then we also have a major area of activity in sort of cross-cutting areas, advanced materials, environmental issues, and analytical services, that kind of thing.
As CEO, what do you see for the future for the Research Council? What are some of the exciting areas that we can expect in the future?
Well, clearly, biotechnology and informatics are rapidly emerging areas and areas where our programs have to continue to develop and in many ways help the province to develop sustainable capacity in those areas. But what's also interesting is in the what people think of as the old economy, we're applying technology in new ways to things like mining of oil sands, to you know, the way in which we harvest trees, the way that we run the mills, and this kind of thing. And it's a very advanced and exotic area. The challenge, actually, is that the systems now are becoming so interconnected and so multidisciplinary that you have to think in quite new ways and be very open-minded about taking ideas that may have been developed in one industry sector and recognizing how to apply them in another. Myself, I guess I would hope to see ARC become a world leader in animal health, because I think that's very important for Alberta. And we have some very strong capabilities here, particularly in the area of animal vaccines. We see the application, as I mentioned, of IT being important in literally everything that seems to go on these days. So we have a rapidly growing health informatics group that's developing large databases based on records of treatment within the health system that we can then mine to develop better mechanisms of delivering care and hopefully more cost-effective mechanisms as well. And so it goes on and on. It's really very exciting.
Now, this information and research and technology is not just sticking in Alberta. It's going around the globe, isn't it?
Well, one of the challenges, of course, is to recognize that everything you do today is really global. And we have to be at the cutting edge globally, not just doing things that might be interesting for Alberta. But on the other hand, we need something that we can apply them to in Alberta if we want them to stay here. So we don't just want to do work that might be interesting that then goes off to another part of the world for its commercial benefit. While there is some benefit from that in terms of perhaps royalties or licenses and other forms of income, in the end what we want is to create businesses here in Alberta that are going to grow and develop and take advantage of this technology. And that means thinking hard to ensure that we see how that technology can actually be effectively applied in this province to industries that exist today, or where we have a natural advantage of some kind. And then from that platform, we want to be able to then export them around the world.
The thing that's really struck me in going through all this is the change in perception. A lot of people, if they're not involved in the sciences, they tend to think of scientists as living very esoteric lives and working away quietly in their labs, but having no real connection to the things that go on in the everyday world. And yet, what you see here is exactly the opposite. Does there need to be a greater change in perception, or do we even have enough people who are involved in the sciences to really carry on the work that needs to be done?
Well, the big challenge, as you and I'm sure most of your listeners will realize, is that people, good people, whether they be scientific people, whether they be business-oriented people, whether they be information technology people, marketing people, whatever, the real shortage is finding good people. Now, you're right. Historically, we all had, I think, this perception of sort of the mad scientist in their lab, working quietly away, doing whatever it was that was so mysterious, and then out would come whatever it was at the end. Today, you have to couple up with industry more quickly. And one of our strengths historically has been that we work very closely with many industry players. So in a typical year, for example, we'll probably have 850 to 900 industrial clients that we'll work with, and that gives us a good appreciation of what their needs are, what their problems are. Then you can try to tune the technology so that in fact it meets those needs. Now, having said all that, it's still, scientists do love to play. They're naturally curious, and they like to do interesting things. And so we've also got to leave them a little bit of room for that curiosity to have its time and make sure they have some resources so they can just get out there and really kind of do the crazy things that somehow turn into remarkable wins. So it's an interesting balance that you have to maintain here of sort of independence on the one hand and yet really focused activity on the other. And quite candidly, if they're allowed to default to independence, they will. And so part of the management challenge is to ensure that they're also challenged by practical industry applications.
What do you like about your job?
Well, first of all, you never know what's going to come next, of course. The ideas, the creativity in this place is astounding. The people are naturally curious. They really, really enjoy new things. And as we all have to change quickly these days, it means that they're much more amenable to change because they're always looking for new and better ways to do things. They want to understand why things work. They're not locked into a particular way of doing their work. So the people, I think, probably in the end become the most exciting part. I think a place like this has to be recognized for what it is, which is really quite unique in Canada. There's really nothing like us anywhere else in the country. And that means that, I believe anyway, for Alberta, that because we can be such an effective bridge between the universities and industry, that allows us to, as a province, to have a much better chance of succeeding, a much better chance of ensuring that the technologies developed in the province stay here, and that there's a support structure to industry to help them deal with some of their key technical problems.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Cheryl. I enjoyed it.
That was John McDougall, Managing Director and CEO of the Alberta Research Council. Next on Innovation Alberta, we step back in time to the year 1920. Thanks to a wonderful grant from the Alberta Historical Resources Foundation, Innovation Alberta brings you a series on the heritage of Alberta's pioneer scientists and innovators. And quite naturally this evening, it's the early history of the Alberta Research Council. I spoke with Dr. Michael Payne, the head of research for historic sites and cultural facilities with Alberta Community Development. Not long after the province of Alberta was established in 1905, there came the University of Alberta. With the First World War, the business community was beginning to see the value of applied research and technology. And by 1920, the politicians were ready to support a collaborative research effort.
What became the Alberta Research Council was created in 1920. It was under the Liberal government in Alberta, headed up by Premier Charles Stewart. And so they decided in 1920 to create a new government agency, which was called at that time, the Advisory Council of Scientific and Industrial Research of Alberta.
But before that, there was the University of Alberta had its industrial laboratory, and then there must have been other people that just pushed the idea to the government.
Right. In 1911, the University of Alberta created something which it called an industrial laboratory to help to answer some of those demands for scientific advice and research assistance that were coming from industry and government departments. In 1919, the University of Alberta, led by its president, Henry Marshall Torrey, they created something called the University Scientific Association. And the intent of this University Scientific Association was to press for more funds for practical applied research. The government of Alberta was approached and agreed to assist in this project, at least in part in the hope that new discoveries that might come out of this collaboration between government and the university, that these new discoveries would help to diversify the Alberta economy and lessen what was seen at that time anyway as too great a reliance on agriculture in the Alberta economy. So the advisory council, which was set up in 1920, was really set up to channel public monies into practical applied research.
Did they have other sorts of labs going on?
Well, at this time, the University of Alberta actually did develop its university farm as a research station in association with the Department of Agriculture, and they did create a couple of new professorships as well. In return, the university agreed to provide office and lab space for the council, which in turn became associated with the university's industrial research department. And the overall intent, as President Tory put it, was to lay the foundations of accurate knowledge upon which we can build our industries with security in the future.
Now, Henry Marshall Tory became one of the really key figures here, didn't he?
Yes, Henry Marshall Tory was probably one of the absolutely key central characters in the creation of the original Alberta Research Council. And I think it's interesting, as a kind of a sidebar to this story, Tory was also one of the leading figures in the establishment of the National Research Council of Canada some years later. And I think it's interesting here because the National Research Council of Canada had very similar objects to the Alberta Research Council. And I think that this is maybe one example anywhere way of a case where a provincial scientific organization actually set the pattern for a national institution.
Now, what happened after 1920?
Well, probably the first major thing was that in 1921 the name changed. An order in council was passed by the government of the day, changing the name of the organization to the Scientific and Industrial Research Council of Alberta. But despite the new name, the intent of the organization really remained the same. It was expected that this Scientific and Industrial Research Council would promote practical applied scientific research through a partnership between the university, the provincial government, and private enterprise. And it's probably also worthwhile noting that at the time, it was intended that the primary research interests of this council would be Alberta's coal and other mineral resources, and also, interestingly, the Athabasca oil, or tar sands, as they were known as at the time.
But at that time, too, you know, you're looking at the differences between what federal responsibilities and provincial responsibilities are, and particularly with regard to natural resources. How did that fit into the scientific research at the time?
Well, some historians have noted that this is actually an interesting thing for the government of Alberta to be doing at the time. Particularly given the topics that this research council was expected to do work in. At the time, natural resources were actually a federal responsibility. And so some people have suggested that the establishment of this research council really reflects a kind of a growing tension between the province and the federal government over ownership of natural resources, and particularly a tension over their desire on the part of provinces to see greater industrial and local benefit from the exploitation of those resources. And some people have also suggested as well that it may reflect a kind of more aggressive political stance on the part of the province of Alberta towards the federal government in the area of natural resources that corresponds with the election of the United Farmers of Alberta government in the province of Alberta after 1921.
Did they have a different view?
Yes, they were very different and probably less oriented towards the federal government than the previous Liberal government had been.
Now, the name changed by order in council in 1921. Did it change again?
Yes. The last change of name that needs to be noted here is that in 1930, the name was changed again to the Research Council of Alberta. I think that's also kind of interesting because the name changed in the very same year as the Natural Resources Transfer Act for Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta came into effect. So there seems to be some kind of, there may be some kind of connection between this transfer of control over natural resources to the provinces and the change in name for this research agency.
Now, the building where the Alberta Research Council is housed today is on Carl Clark Road. Clark's work on how to get the oil from the oil sands certainly was an important part in the beginning. But did the Research Council then begin to turn to other areas to do research?
Oil sands research was a major part of what the council was up to. But in the 1920s, the council also undertook other projects in other areas of research, including work detailing Alberta's coal reserves. They worked on some potential uses for Turner Valley's natural gas, which at the time was basically flared off as waste material. By the late 1920s and early 1930s, the Research Council had really settled into five main research sections or areas. They had a fuel section, which really looked after coal. They had a geology section, a soil section, a natural gas section, which was interested in the Turner Valley issues, and the road materials section, which was really their oil sands research program. And just to give people a sense of the sort of size and scale of this operation, in 1923, the budget for this this program was $36,000 a year, of which $16,000 went towards salary costs. Interestingly, by comparison, Alberta's total provincial budget at the time was $9 million. And so, if you like, the council represented about 1/250th of the overall provincial budget. By 1930, the council actually was spending approximately $85,000 a year, but $40,000 of that in salary. So obviously scientists were less expensive then than now. Once again, out of a total provincial budget of $15 million at the time, it had actually grown to about 1/175th of the total provincial budget.
But then we're at 1930, and the Depression is coming, economics all around the world is changing. Did that have any effect on the work of the Research Council?
The Depression actually had a major impact on this kind of research and funding of this research. After 1930, the amount of money available to the Research Council began to dip, and by 1933, the council was actually closed down because of declining government revenue. It was then reconstituted as an agency of the provincial government in the early 1940s, at a time when governments were once again willing to fund applied research. So I'd just like to sort of, by way of conclusion, we might note that during this early period of time, up to 1933, the Research Council was never really a big government expense, but an indication of the importance of the initiatives that it was undertaking can be seen in the fact that the council reported directly to the premier. In fact, the council reported directly to the premier up to 1971. And in its early years, apparently the premier actually served as the official chair of the council. So it was seen as being perhaps not one of the big expenditure items of the government, but it was certainly seen as an important part of what the government of Alberta was doing.
Thank you very much, Michael.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Michael Payne, Head of Research for Historic Sites and Cultural Facilities with Alberta Community Development. One of the biggest challenges for water treatment in northern Alberta is keeping the parasites Giardia and Cryptosporidium out of the drinking water. Giardia causes beaver fever, and Cryptosporidium is associated with scours in livestock. In humans, these bugs cause stomach upsets and explosive diarrhea. And for the young, the elderly, and those with weak immune systems, infection can mean death. These parasites are endemic in the North Saskatchewan watershed. Chlorine does not kill them, so they have to be filtered out of the water. 1997 was a particularly bad year for Giardia and Cryptosporidium. So in 1998, EPCOR, along with a number of agencies including the Alberta Beef Council and the University of Alberta, undertook a three-year study to find out how these parasites were getting into the North Saskatchewan River, the source of Edmonton's drinking water. One of the bright young researchers working on the project under Dr. Stephen Stanley was a graduate student named Cindy Chappelle. I spoke with Cindy at the Rossdale Water Treatment Plant, where she is now a watershed engineer with EPCOR.
Well, I had to do the water sampling. I went out with sampling runs and processed the samples in the field, did flow measurements. I came back into the lab and learned how to analyze the Cryptosporidium and Giardia filters once they were in the lab. I had to take all the data, the raw data, and analyze it and put it into its proper compartments and draw conclusions and write a thesis.
And what was the conclusion of your thesis?
Well, the conclusion of my thesis, like many others, was more work's needed. what I was doing in my thesis was trying to look at loading and where the sources of Cryptosporidium and Giardia were coming from and comparing them in the upstream watershed to what we observed at the E.L. Smith water treatment plant. So what my conclusions were was that the sewage treatment lagoons were discharging at the improper times of the year. And if we could change that, we know through past research that lagoons that hold their contents over the summer and get that UV disinfection, it significantly reduces the amount of Cryptosporidium and Giardia, fecal coliform, that sort of thing that's being discharged into the watershed. So that was a big conclusion of mine from my thesis. Some other conclusions were that the wildlife watersheds were contributing to Cryptosporidium and Giardia, and no one thought that they would when we initiated this research. We thought it was just going to come from the high beef cattle and the high agriculture watersheds. I also found that Giardia was coming from the water treatment plants all year long, and that was another constant loading source that we saw at E.L. Smith. That was a constant background amount of Giardia that was out there. It was pretty small in comparison with what we see during spring runoff and summer rainstorms from the water, the creeks upstream, but it was a constant source. And if we can reduce those constant background sources, then it's better for everyone all around.
This work earned Cindy Chappelle her master thesis, and it contributed to the larger three-year study. At $800,000, it's the largest of its kind in North America, and in fact, the world. The study covers an area 27,000 kilometers in size, from the Rocky Mountains to Edmonton, and it has gained Alberta a worldwide reputation as a center of expertise on Giardia and Cryptosporidium.
We're getting a lot of interest from other places on how the project's going, what sort of information we're finding, how we modeled our project, how we did our sampling. All sorts of requests have come in.
From where?
I've gotten requests from Idaho, one from Alaska. We've gotten requests from New Jersey, Philadelphia. I think also we had a few from Ontario as well, actually.
That was Cindy Chappelle, researcher and watershed engineer with EPCOR. You can find out more about this issue by checking the webpage for the North Saskatchewan Watershed Alliance. That's at nswa.ab.ca. Well, that wraps up the first episode of Innovation Alberta, a program about science, research, and technology in Alberta. Please check our website at innovationalberta.ckua.com. Our technical producer is Scott Franchuk. The Innovation Alberta theme was composed and produced all on computer by two young musicians, Ruben De Toledo and Chris Andrews. And thanks to the generous sponsors who have made all of this possible. See you again at this time next week. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Good night.